A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Talk Radio. Across the UK. Online. On DAB. And on your smart speaker. This is Talk Radio.
Good morning. It's Monday, the 17th of February. You're listening to Breakfast with Mike Graham, standing in for Julia Hartley Brewer right here on Talk Radio. Coming up, it's been a very sad weekend in the news. TV presenter Caroline Flack took her own life, age 40, and there's been a huge outpouring of love for her. But there are so many people trying to point the finger of blame at the media, at ITV, at the legal system, at social media, even at the police. Why are we trying to find someone to blame for this tragic news? I'll speak to psychologists and people who knew Caroline Flack well. Also, I'll talk about the plans for number 10 to scrap the BBC licence fee in favour of a subscription model. And Britain's on board the quarantined Diamond Princess cruise ship in Japan are accusing the government of forgetting about them. I'll find out if we should still be worried about the coronavirus. Plus, John Hammond from Weather Trending will join me after a weekend of wind, rain and flooding, courtesy of Storm Dennis. It's 5 minutes past seven in the morning. It is Monday. You're listening to me, Mike Graham, right here on Talk Radio.
Across the UK, online, on DAB and on your smart speaker. This is Talk Radio.
And we are also live streaming this show on YouTube, so I am delighted to tell you that for the first time on Breakfast, you'll be able to watch it as well as listening to it. I'm in the company this morning of Neil Wallace, former tabloid editor, media commentator as well, and Eric McElroy, American commentator and comedian. Morning to both of you.
Morning.
Let's welcome now Jo Hemmings, behavioural psychologist, relationship expert, a woman I speak to very often on my show, which starts at 10. I'm sorry, Jo, that you've had to get up at 7 o'clock this morning to talk to me.
It's all right, I forgive you.
I know you've forgiven me, that's very kind of you. An awful lot of the papers this morning still with pages and pages and pages of coverage of the terrible story about Caroline Flack. I mean, I've been asking this morning the guys here, but also the people listening to the show, there seems to be a sense at the moment that we need to find someone to blame for this, which I find a bit unfortunate, really, because I think in the end, sometimes terrible things do happen and it's not always somebody's fault.
No, but we have to make some sense of what happened. It's important for people to, I mean, that's why everyone, you know, from the press to social media, whatever, being found accountable, because we have to make some sense of what seems a completely extraordinary and awful, tragic killing, you know, suicide of a young girl. And actually, in truth, I think all of these parts, from ITV to the press to social media to the CPS, they're all culpable in some way because, you know, it's part, not individually, but it's part of obviously a bigger and more threatening picture that Caroline Flack had in her mind. Which ultimately caused her to take her own life.
Yeah. I mean, there are those, of course, who will say that the whole sort of culture that we've created around reality TV is not entirely healthy for people, particularly those people who might be a bit mentally vulnerable.
Well, I think to a degree that's true, but of course Caroline wasn't a contestant. She was a presenter, which puts it, and I think, you know, the fact she presented Love Island is just a very sad coincidence. But I do think what it does bring into play is, you know, people in the public eye that we've always assumed, where we know that the contestants are vulnerable and there's work being done to make sure they have support. For people who present programmes, there is the implicit assumption, and I think that's where our shock came from, that they will be able to cope, that they have, you know, those coping mechanisms that sort of get what the press or social media are throwing at them. In this case, clearly not. And that's, I think, where we need to look.
Yeah.
You know, who's supporting those people?
I mean, as far as the kind of... nobody knows for sure what was in Caroline's mind. Nobody knows for sure what might have affected her decision. And nobody really understands any of that, and we probably never will. But, you know, the one thing that we can say that's new in this whole conversation, there's always been press intrusion, there's always been television companies that made shows that might be termed exploitative. What is new, I think, in all of this is the way that ordinary people can get a Twitter account or an Instagram account or a Facebook account and just hurl horrible barbs, nasty abuse and just disgraceful words at people they don't even know.
I agree, and I think there's sort of two points going on there. One is that when they see the press go on the attack, then they see it sort of green lit for them to be able to see the same thing, because if the press is doing it, why shouldn't they? And I'm not saying the press shouldn't cover these kind of stories. They should, but they should do them particularly with far less salacious, cruel headlines. There needs to be a more empathetic way of covering these stories that aren't on the attack. And secondly, as Twitter... You know, it drives the good people off Twitter. When you see this sort of thing, people think, oh, do you know what? I don't want to be on the social platform anymore. It's all angry people. It's all people being abusive. And so what happens is you get this kind of polarized Twitterati that are literally, you know, it's the cruel ones that sort of stand head and shoulders above everybody else because the good guys don't like it anymore.
But is it part of the problem as well, though, Joe, that they're basically... Much of the abuse comes from people who are anonymous, who don't have proper accounts, who are not properly policed, and who basically could do whatever they like, safe in the knowledge that nobody will ever know who they are.
Yes, I think a great deal of it is that. I mean, it happened to me recently. I actually reported somebody, and there were three or four really unpleasant tweets. Twitter came back to me and said, we haven't found any hate in there. So they carried on.
Well, the Twitter rules for banning people are quite bizarre. I mean, I've had death threats. I've had people threatening to shoot me, people telling me there's a bullet with my name on it. And apparently that doesn't violate the Twitter rules.
Yeah, so I think the Twitter rules need some fairly urgent review.
I don't know if that's just the rules for me, by the way. I don't know.
Well, no, it's rules for everybody. It's horrible when it happens to you. And
it is.
It sort of gathers pace. It has a ripple effect.
Yeah.
Other people join in the bundle and then suddenly you've just... There's a tsunami of vileness heading in your direction. And I don't understand in their rules why they can't see that cumulative effect, if you like. It's not individuals. It's just them all piggybacking on each other for attention.
Mm.
How that is unacceptable.
And do you see any way that this will change? Because clearly, you know, people will go into their kind of go back into their shells, perhaps to some extent, when something like this happens. Because even the really horrible people know that it's probably not a very good time to be horrible. But it doesn't ever change anything, does it?
I mean, that worries me. Something else fundamental needs to change. Because I think what happens is we've got this outpouring of people saying, "Be kind." And actually, I'm afraid the way our press and the way Twitter works currently is not that we're kind. We don't want to see lots of jolly little kind tweets. It doesn't get our engagement and it doesn't make them thrive. They don't make money out of that if people aren't engaging with the tweets. So it's sort of encouraging the dark side of us implicitly to come out. And that's just so many shades of wrong. So something has to change.
Yeah,
you know,
but also by
the
same token, Joe, I would say that you have to be very careful as well, do you not, about saying to newspapers, well, you know, you can't be critical anymore, because in the end there's a big difference between somebody writing a column which is critical of someone but done it in a way which is what you might consider to be acceptable. You know, it starts to go down a dangerous road if you say, well, you can't be critical of anybody.
Indeed, it totally does. So I think you can be critical. And what I really find the worst are the headlines, because that's what you see in huge capital letters screaming at you from the front of certain tabloids. And, you know, even if what they wrote, which I don't think at the moment is particularly well-written or empathetic, you don't see that. You just see this relentless flow of hideous headlines. And that, I think, needs to change. Report on it by all means, but just give it a bit of consideration before you... splash nastiness on your front pages in that way.
Okay. Joe Hemmings, thank you very much indeed. Behavioural psychologist, relationship expert.
Online, on DAB, and on the Talk Radio app. Talk Radio.
I'm going to talk now to Nazir Afzal, former chief prosecutor, because a lot of the newspapers this morning, obviously covering the very tragic news at the weekend that Caroline Flack took her own life. many of them are saying that she feared a show trial. She was terrified, according to the Daily Mail, about a police body cam film of her. She had warned police officers that she would take her own life. There had apparently been some kind of a 999 crew visit to her home the day before she took her own life. Let's find out from Nazir precisely what he makes of the claims that the police should have gone easy on her. Nazir, a very good morning, morning to you. Welcome.
Good morning to you.
Thanks very much for joining us. I mean, I'm slightly uneasy about this whole idea of blaming various organisations, whether it be the media, whether it be the police, whether it be ITV. You know, I'm not sure that sometimes we shouldn't just absorb terrible news like this and understand that sometimes these things happen.
I agree with you. The blame culture, it's understandable. That's what we're like as a society. We always want somebody to, I don't know, be held responsible. But I can only talk about the police and prosecution in this. I know from my experience of working with police officers and prosecutors for a quarter of a century that they take, firstly, domestic abuse very seriously. We have an epidemic in this country. 750,000 reports to police, 75,000 prosecutions a year. But every single one of them is treated exactly the same way. They look at the evidence. And in this case, as you said, there was a complainant who made an allegation. There was a 999 call that was recorded. The officers attended with body-worn camera, and they captured the scene and what's happening and who's saying what. There were interviews. There's medical evidence. And they took the view, as they would do with any other similar case, that this was a case worth putting before a court. They don't make the judgment. They just decided that there was enough for it to go before a court. Then, of course, you have the quite uncommon situation where the complainant withdraws and says they don't want to support the prosecution. And in those circumstances, because it happens so frequently, they have a process and they apply that process. Is there enough evidence? And they decided clearly there was still. And let the court decide. And, you know, I think there are issues around duty of care. Who is responsible for looking after Caroline? Well, I would suggest that the defense lawyers would, you know, they are meant to make the prosecution aware of any vulnerabilities. I don't know if they did or not. And additionally, communication has to be done in a very sensitive way. So those are things that I hope will come out during the next few days when people investigate it further. But I don't think you can attach any blame to police and prosecutors simply doing their job.
I mean, is there any onus on the CPS or indeed on the police at any point during an investigation to see whether there is vulnerability or to see whether an individual might not be quite strong enough to face charges? I mean, I don't imagine there is.
They have actually policy in place which says that you must look after the vulnerable people, and that means assess the vulnerability. But you've got to weigh that up against the seriousness of the crime. A lot of vulnerable people kill people, for example.
Yes.
And you wouldn't say they shouldn't be prosecuted for murder. So they have a balance to take. They decided in this case that the allegations were serious enough and the evidence was strong enough that it outweighed any concerns they had about her vulnerability. But, you know, as I say, that's a judgment call based on what information they had. I don't know what information they had, but I assume that they had sufficient to be able to make that judgment.
Yes. And if you look at the numbers of people in domestic violence cases who decide for one reason or another they don't want to press charges against their partner, I mean, there's many of those cases which the police view as sort of undue influence being exerted or possibly bullying being going on. So there's no reason why, as some people have suggested, that should have meant that they didn't press ahead.
100%. We have a significant problem with that. For all the reasons you mentioned, and additional reasons, men tend to withdraw their support for a prosecution because of shame, because they somehow feel that they are, you know, they've brought it upon themselves.
Yes.
So there are all sorts of reasons why they may not pursue the prosecution. But that's why we have an independent prosecution service, to make that judgment on behalf of us, the public, and not just on behalf of the person who's made the complaint.
Quite. And as far as the delay in the court system, just because of the sheer volume of cases and from what we've heard of the sort of the lack of resources, perhaps in some cases, for the legal system in general, some people have been critical of the length of time that it takes from the incident to the charge to the actual court appearance. Is that a fair criticism, that sometimes the longer that goes on, the more sort of stressful it can become?
You've put it better than I could. Absolutely right. It's shameful, actually, the amount of time it takes. And that is resources. There are fewer courts, fewer judges, fewer barristers, fewer prosecutors. That means that these cases do take longer than they should do. If they were dealt with in days, if not weeks, I think people would be able to see justice done. They would also see that the trauma can be managed in some way. But if you are waiting 12 months, 18 months for the case to be finalized, well, I'm afraid we're re-traumatizing them. Yes. The whole system is re-traumatizing them, and we've got to really get a handle on this.
And what about the way that the CPS and the police will now kind of go? Will there be an investigation that is officially done into this if this happens?
Well, I mean, during my career, half a dozen people took their lives whilst we were prosecuting them. And every single one of them, I looked back at all the casework to make sure the right decisions were taken by the right people. And, you know, it's important to do that. It's also important to protect, or not protect, but to support the people who made the decision. Because I remember how it impacted on me, thinking, hang on a minute, was I in some way responsible for somebody taking their life? And so it's important to provide support. Yes, absolutely important to understand and find out what happened. I'm hopeful that once this case has been finally discontinued, it has to be formally dropped in court, that the Director of Public Prosecutions and the Chief Prosecutors will open up to us and share with us their decision making, because I think the more transparency in anything, as you will appreciate, the more understanding.
Across the UK, online, on DAB, and on your smart speaker, Talk Radio.
The front pages of various problems around the country due to Storm Dennis. Front page of the Daily Telegraph: fire crews in Bridge Street, Crickhowell in Wales, rescuing residents in a dinghy, effectively, because it looks like they're under about 18 inches, 2 feet of water. Let's talk now to John Hammond from Weather Trending, because, of course, he's the man who was telling me all about this just last week and how terrible the storm season was going to be. Very good morning to you, John. It wasn't, in the end, for an awful lot of the country, as bad as the previous weekend.
Well, it's funny you say that, yeah. I mean, it wasn't, in terms of rainfall, I mean, there was a lot of rain this weekend. But actually, if you look at it in isolation, the sort of rainfall totals we had, Mike, through this weekend were not that phenomenal. They were high, and in some places, yeah, you had a month's worth of rainfall in 24 hours. But we have that, I'm not saying often, but we have that every so often. The problem was that it was on top of what happened with Ciara. So you have to combine the two, and the fact that Ciara delivered a lot of rain,
yeah,
which didn't have time to dry out, and it was the cumulative effect of those two storms which just tipped the balance, sort of metaphorically, and led to all that flooding. Because as we've said before, you know, the ground just can't take any more water at the moment. We need several days, if not weeks, to dry out.
Yeah.
My concern is that although I can't see any one particular storm on the horizon that I can pinpoint on the weather map and say, well, that's going to hit us next Thursday. There are several developments out in the Atlantic which have the potential to give another dose of wet weather through the next couple of weeks, all of which will just mean that matters will remain critical, shall we say, because we won't have that opportunity to dry out. And so if we get another inch of rain, that, again, could cause flooding, which was more than you'd normally expect with an inch of rain, if you get my gist.
Yes, I do. I was driving up from Sussex yesterday. There's an awful lot of water on the road, an awful lot of standing water, if you like. And in fact, quite a few of the roads between sort of Brighton and London were closed due to flooding. And an awful lot of the runoff from the fields is now getting quite bad.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm heading that way actually this afternoon, so it'll be interesting to see what I find. I'm not expecting things to suddenly dry out like a puddle dries out on a nice spring summer's day. It's just gonna sit there, and the groundwater levels are so high as well. I live in a part of the country in the Chilterns actually where many valleys, chalk valleys, have been dry for a year or two or three because it's been relatively dry for that long. Well, those chalk river valleys are now absolute torrents, which is a measure of how much water there is underneath the surface, Mike. And so we're not going to get out of this quandary, you know, quickly. This is a slow burner in terms of recovery and getting things safe again for the country. It's going to take, you know, a week, two, 3 weeks of dry weather. And I can't see on the weather maps any hope of that, because the jet stream is really strong, as it has been all winter long. There's no sign of any high pressure which is going to sit over us for that period of time. So, yes, some dry spells. And this week, for example, is a pretty normal week meteorologically. There'll be some sunshine, there'll be some showers. But what we need is a lot of dry weather for several days, and I can't see that on the weather map.
Well, maybe what you need is a supercomputer, John, because the Met Office is going to spend 1.2 billion quid, apparently, on a supercomputer to improve weather and climate forecasting. So that's what you need to get your hands on.
Indeed, yes. A lot of money.
It is a lot of money. I mean, I'm glad they've got that sort of money to spend. But, I mean, are we going to see a few more storms before we see the spring properly kind of kick in?
I wouldn't be at all surprised. As I say, I mean, I've been hoping, expecting that we're going to see a big blocking high pressure later on in the winter. It just hasn't materialised. You can actually trace the issue up to the top of the atmosphere, Mike, the polar vortex. A polar vortex is a phrase which is used wrongly to denote freezing cold weather, which is heading our way. Quite the opposite. When you've got a strong polar vortex at the top of the atmosphere, that tends to drive a strong jet stream. And we've had a really strong polar vortex all winter. It's still there, and that's still steering a very strong jet stream around the Northern Hemisphere. And when we've got a strong jet stream, that's bad news, because that propels deep areas of low pressure from the Atlantic and catapults them across our shores. And really, not a lot is going to change through the next week or 10 days. So as I said earlier on, though I can't, on the weather map, pinpoint one particular development and say that's heading our way and that's going to give us storm, whatever it's going to be, Ellen. The potential is there for something to spin up and produce a lot more rain. So we'll keep you posted. But yeah, no sign of any prolonged dry weather, I'm afraid.
Online, on DAB, and on the Talk Radio app. Talk Radio.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Across the UK, online, on DAB, and on your smart speaker, Talk Radio.
Caroline Flack took her own life aged 40, and there's been a huge outpouring of love for her, but there are so many people trying to point the finger of blame at the media, at ITV, at the legal system, at the CPS, at the police, social media. Why are we trying to find someone to blame for this terrible, awful, tragic news? Sometimes you just have to accept that terrible things do happen. And yes, it might well be that some things need to be looked upon differently. Perhaps Love Island itself is not one of the greatest ideas anybody ever had for a reality TV show. I've been speaking to people who knew Caroline Flack. I've been speaking to psychologists, of course, as well. And the picture that is painted of her is of a very vulnerable young woman who had done very well in the television business and who was friends with many journalists and knew exactly what it was that she was into and what she was going to probably get out of it. However, she was also clearly a woman who was very, very upset at what had happened between her and her boyfriend, and she was apparently dreading a trial that was going to be unleashed upon her and the rest of us as well. We've also talked about the plans to scrap the BBC licence fee. We've got some calls to take on that. We'll take more of those. 03444991000. Right now, though, let us talk to Dan Hodges from The Mail on Sunday, because in the background to all of the Boris Johnson reshuffle business and Sajid Javid leaving the cabinet, we've still got the battle for the next Labour leader going on. Emily Thornberry, of course, now dropped out of the race, so we're left with three candidates: Rebecca Long-Bailey, Keir Starmer and Lisa Nandy. Dan, very good morning to you. Welcome.
Morning. Thank you.
Thanks very much for joining us. It feels to me as though there's this kind of bubble that exists out there, which only includes people who watch the BBC and who vote as members of the Labour Party. It's almost as though it's all going on around us, and if you're not involved in it, you're not really that bothered.
Well, I think, I mean, not only is it a bubble, I mean, it's a never-expanding and seemingly interminable bubble. The Labour leadership contest is going to be with us for several, you know, at least a month and a half, yeah. And I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, my own view is the Labour leadership contest is exactly what the Labour Party didn't need. It didn't, or certainly the way it's been conducted isn't what the Labour Party needed. I mean, Labour suffered, by any accounts, a catastrophic defeat back in December. It needed to really sort of step back, take a long, hard look at itself, take a long, hard look about why it lost again, and take a long, hard look about how it can re-engage with the public. And that's clearly not what's happening. The Labour Party is again engaged in a sort of never-ending discussion with itself. And the views of the electorate, the views of the people that Labour is going to need to reach out to if it is ever to gain power again, are just simply not featuring in the Labour leadership debate at the moment.
Well, they're really not, and they're getting bogged down in what can only be described as kind of the minutiae of Labour Party policy on relatively minor policy planks, if you like, for example, safe spaces for women, whether or not trans women are women, all of the stuff that kind of drove them into a dead end of a cul-de-sac in the last election campaign. They don't seem to have learned anything from that.
I mean, I think you're being a little, even with that, I think you're being overly generous. I mean, I don't think there is even any sort of great detailed sort of granular analysis of policy. Mm. There's just a series of bland statements, the most sort of profound of which are, we have to listen. But then there doesn't seem to be any listening going on.
No, then they don't listen.
No, exactly, but then they don't listen. Or if they do listen, the only people they appear to be interested in listening to is the Labour Party membership. And even that, within that, it's not even the Labour membership generally. All of the candidates are essentially pitching their message to a section of the electorate, the Labour electorate, Labour membership, that basically seem to crave a continuation of some form or other of Corbynism. Excuse me, be that, you know, hardcore sort of Corbynism of the form being advocated by Rebecca Long-Bailey, or Corbynism with a haircut in the form of Sir Keir Starmer. Mm. There is no serious analysis of why Labour lost or what Labour has to do to win.
No, quite. And also, this is a good time for Labour to be on the attack against Boris Johnson and his government, not least because people like me, who would generally speaking be in support of Boris Johnson, I've been quite critical of what he's been doing over the last week or so and how some things are unfolding and how, you know, Dominic Cummings is clearly more powerful than anybody thought he was at this particular point. But what you get now is this ridiculous spectacle of Jeremy Corbyn at Prime Minister's Question, standing there like a dead man walking, you know, incapable of landing a punch on him.
Well, absolutely. I mean, as you said, we've got the situation where Dominic Cummings seems to have launched a coup within government. We had Boris's first reshuffle last week, in which he couldn't even get through it without losing his chancellor. There have been a lot of sort of concerns within government about the general lack of direction and the sense that since, you know, Boris won the election, got the majority, he doesn't actually really have that much of an idea what to do with it. We have all these self-inflicted, sort of, as it were, internal rows breaking out every week. But as you say, the Labour Party isn't in a position to capitalise on
it. No.
I mean, what I would say is, look, we've got a long way to go. I mean, you know, this government's here for four or five years. I mean, it's absolutely right that, you know, Labour has to think strategically at the moment rather than sort of running around just trying to sort of knock little lumps off Boris Johnson here or there. But it's, but as I say, it's not even doing that. I mean, there is no evidence at the moment that the Labour Party is in any way trying to think about what it needs to reinvent itself.
And is somebody else going to drop out, I presume? I mean, Lisa Nandy is a sort of curious figure, it seems to me. I know there are many in the sort of more central areas of the Labour Party who think that she might be the answer. But in fact, she's quite left-wing, really. She only looks centrist when next to Rebecca Longbody, doesn't she?
Well, I think the thing about Lisa is, I mean, you said, you know, some in Labour think she might be the answer. I mean, what's interesting is there are even a couple of Tories who think she might be the answer, or if not the answer, certainly the person left in the contest that might give the Tories and Boris problems. You know, she has got authenticity. She is somebody who can speak with authority about the problems of, you know, the collapse of Labour's Northern Wall. I'm not entirely sure I agree that she's particularly left-wing. Certainly she's not left-wing in terms of where she's positioning herself in relation to Rebecca Long-Bailey, or increasingly where Keir Starmer seems to want the Labour Party to think he's...
No, but she would have been considered left-wing in the old Tony Blair days, wouldn't she?
Exactly. But, I mean, you know, frankly, I don't know anybody in the Labour Party who thinks that, you know, in a month and a half's time, Lisa Nandy is going to emerge as the party leader. We seem to have these two. It seems to basically be boiling down to Rebecca Long-Bailey or Sir Keir Starmer. And actually, within that, I've got to be honest, I can't find many people who don't think Sir Keir Starmer is going to be the next Labour leader. But then if you ask them what sort of Labour leader he's going to be, you get a lot of blank looks.
Yeah, absolutely right. Dan, thanks very much indeed. Dan Hodges there from The Mail on Sunday, talking about the problem that currently exists in the Labour Party, where basically the people who are up for the new leadership role are not really likely to change anything anytime soon. And even worse than that, it's not actually going to happen anytime soon either.
Online, on DAB and on the Talk Radio app. Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Breakfast Show on Talk Radio with me, Mike Graham, in for Julie Hartley Brewer, powered by The Times, helping you make the most well-informed decisions. Lots of good stories in The Times today, of course. A second storm in a week brings flood, misery and travel chaos. Amazing aerial picture of Crick Howell in southeast Powys, which was completely cut off after the River Usk burst its banks. Storm Dennis brought more than a month's rainfall in 48 hours to parts of Wales, so... condolences if that's where you are and that's what you're fighting today, because it's going to take some time to get all that back to normal. One of the big stories we've been talking about this morning, though, is the BBC, not least because yesterday in the Sunday Times it was revealed that not only does Boris Johnson and Dominic Cummings and the rest of the Tory government want to look at the BBC, they are actively engaged in a process by which to remove the licence fee, to certainly decriminalise non-payment of it, and also to slim down the organisation to quite a large extent. Let's talk now to Professor Tim Luckhurst, Principal of South College at Durham University and a former BBC executive as well. Tim, a very good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike.
Thanks very much indeed for joining us. It looks like these are quite dangerous times for the BBC, doesn't it?
Certainly the BBC is facing more intense scrutiny from this government than it ever expected, and more intense scrutiny than it has experienced from government at any time in recent history. And that will be causing grave concern inside the BBC. It's causing grave concern to all those of us who think that a BBC capable of providing core public services is a very important national institution and one that we should preserve. So, yes, I think the BBC is facing a real crisis.
Yeah, it really is. Because I think a little bit like, and you may not like my sort of analogy here, but it's a little bit like my arguments that I had with people about the European Union to some extent. The BBC's original charter was a magnificent thing. Some of the things the BBC has done in the past, they should be very rightly proud of. And many of the things they still do, they should be rightly proud of. But they've kind of expanded to beyond the point of what they originally had in mind, don't you think?
Yes, I do agree with you that the BBC has expanded in such a way that it now seeks to be all things to all Britons.
Yeah.
And I would argue that that was not what it was created to be. I think that there is fault on both sides in this argument. The government seems to imagine that it's possible to create a smaller, more efficient BBC, which provides excellent news and current affairs on TV, on radio and online, excellent theatre, excellent music, original comedy, etc., without a licence fee. And I think that's preposterous, because those are the very things which commercial financing wouldn't pay for. But equally, the BBC should not be competing on territory which commercial broadcasters and commercial streaming services can provide and do provide very effectively. It should be providing those things which are valuable, which we may not always want, but which is a society we desperately need in order to enhance the quality of our public debate and the quality of our arts and culture. The BBC can do that brilliantly with a smaller licence fee and a slightly as a smaller corporation. And I don't understand why the government can't reach a rapid agreement that the BBC should do that. But that takes collaboration from within the BBC as well. It's got to give up this notion of doing everything for everybody. It simply doesn't need to do that.
No, I think you're absolutely right, because I imagine there'd be people within the BBC who would see this as very much the thin end of the wedge, and if they cooperate in any way with a kind of hiving off of certain sections of their organisation, that they'll see that as just the beginning, and they won't know where it ends.
Well, that's why this needs to be a thorough, sensible and reasonable debate, because of course there are people in the BBC very reasonably who worry that any reduction in its scale means the end of the corporation. And if that were to be the case, that would be a disaster, and they'd be absolutely right. But look, we're talking about this as if it has to be decided tomorrow. The reality is the BBC's licence fee, its royal charter, is guaranteed until 2027. That's longer than this government has been elected to remain in office. It's perfectly reasonable to have a sensible conversation about what the BBC should do, a conversation about what the BBC should not do, and to reach a really sensible consensus which can then be enshrined in a charter and, I hope, guaranteed for a very long time. There is time for that, and there are plenty of people on both sides of the House of Commons who agree that that is the sort of conversation we should be having.
And what's the danger here of the political process, I suppose, being accused of being responsible for this, i.e., you know, those in the Tory party, those in Downing Street, who really don't like the BBC and who are using their kind of unpopularity, if you like, abroad in terms of what the ordinary people of this country are thinking at the moment, using that as a stick to beat them with?
I think there's an element of punishment beating going on at the moment. The BBC probably didn't have a brilliant election. And one of the reasons I would suggest that it didn't have a brilliant election was that it was slow to understand where the sentiment in favour of Britain leaving the European Union came from, and slow to understand that the majority in favour of leaving was a legitimate majority. I voted Remain, but I accepted from the very beginning of this process that there was a referendum and my side lost, and that if one is a Democrat, one has to accept that. I think the mindset inside BBC News and Current Affairs was probably a little behind the curve on that, and it didn't give the sort of coverage which in the past has made it world famous for its balance, impartiality and fairness. Now, I don't think the BBC has lost that ability to be one of the world's finest producers of excellent news and current affairs. In fact, I'm convinced that it has a great deal to teach many others about impartiality and fairness. But it must now calm down, recognise that there is a proper debate to be had, and that if it begins to propose a new shape, a shape which makes it really fit the modern, changed multimedia environment, then there are plenty of people in the Conservative Party who are very sensible. John Whittingdale, who's just returned to the Department of Culture, Media and Sport as Minister of State, is an exceptionally well-informed politician. This is not somebody who doesn't understand the role the BBC plays in British society. He has criticised it, but I don't think it's fair to call Mr. Whittingdale an enemy of the BBC.
No, I think you're
very
absolutely right.
Full minister.
Is it time as well for them to rethink some of their programming in the sense of, I mean, I've always been sort of curious about why the BBC produces a show like Strictly. I know it's incredibly successful. I know that they can probably, sell it abroad and all of that. But in the end, you know, it costs an awful lot of money to put together. It's star-studded. It's all about creating a sort of a culture around a show which can then be, turned into a stage extravaganza and a production that tours. I'm not sure that's their job.
I'm afraid I agree entirely. I think that the BBC exists to be a benchmark of quality, not to be an organisation which competes almost like a commercial entity with the private sector. Strictly Come Dancing's great entertainment, but it's precisely the kind of show that could be funded by subscription, which could be funded by a commercial broadcaster, which would be made by the commercial sector. What the BBC is brilliant at is nurturing new and original talent, such as the talent that created a comedy like Fleabag, making superb documentary, so it's the sort of material that Richard Attenborough has worked on in the past. It is superb at providing eyewitness testimony to global news and reporting accurately online, on television and on radio. But does it need to make music radio? I've never understood why the BBC tramples all over the terrain in which commercial radio stations seek to operate by broadcasting music. That is not something which a public service broadcaster needs to do. Original music, yes, but the pop charts, utterly unnecessary.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. Professor Tim Luckhurst there, who is, of course, now a lecturer and a professor at Durham University, former BBC executive, of course, as well. Let's talk to Simon, who's a first-time caller from Bath, wants to talk about the Beeb. Hello, Simon.
Hello, how are you?
Very well indeed. Thanks for calling. What can I do for you?
Yeah, I just wanted to make a point, and you're a great show, by the way.
I used to listen
to Radio 4 and the BBC, but it's so woke, the propaganda, the drip,
yeah, it's
drip,
terrible.
Every talk show, every drama, every talent show is a woke message. But I've completely switched to the commercial offering now.
Right.
You guys, in particular, you
right.
and Julia, fantastic. And I think it was a real journalistic failing of the BBC during the Brexit coverage, actually, not to look at both sides. But one point I think you're both missing, you've had some great experts this morning, but everyone's been saying that there's now advertisements on the BBC. Now, I work in advertising sales, and I used to sell advertising space on the behalf of the BBC products. And I can tell you now that if you were to add up, in advertising, it's time and space and audience. And if you were to add up all the advertisements on the BBC promoting their own wares, they spend more money than Tesco, Ford and Coca-Cola combined.
Yeah, it drives me insane. I mean, because every time, you know, we're in the radio business here, but we're now moving more into the TV business as well. But every time they do an advert for BBC Sounds before the news, you know, get so-and-so's podcast. It's like, you know, that is worth, and you're absolutely right, millions to people.
Absolutely. And the point being is all advertising is interrupts by its nature. Interrupts your viewing, your listening, your reading. And the BBC advertises itself more than any other brand. It's the number one brand in the country. And the bill for this, zero.
I know.
Absolutely nothing.
Well, I mean, that's not to mention the placement of people on The One Show, for example. The only thing The One Show does is basically promote all the other shows that the BBC puts out.
It's an advertorial, it's editorial content,
yep.
Pretending that it's not commercial. And they have so many different avenues to promote as well. For me, I'd quite happily get rid of the whole lot of the BBC and say, go commercial, stand on your own feet, and fight in the real world, get real.
And start again. Simon, you're absolutely right. What a great call. Simon, the first-time caller to Talk Radio. Let's go back to the phones and talk some more about the BBC. Peter is in Bridlington in Yorkshire. Hello, Peter.
Oh, good morning, Mike. Yes, my views on the BBC are that we need to get back to it only providing BBC One and BBC Two. It used to put a whole range of programmes on that before it expanded dramatically.
Do you know how many TV channels the BBC have actually got?
It's about five or six, isn't it?
It's 10.
10?
Yeah, it's 10.
You've got the worldwide ones as well.
Yeah,
now,
exactly. BBC Parliament, the 1, 2, 3, and 4... they've got BBC Parliament, they've got CBeebies, which is a separate channel. They've got BBC Three, which is not meant to be a channel, but still is.
Yeah, well, I would just take it back to BBC One and BBC Two, because we've got to remember there are still people in this country who only watch linear TV.
Yeah.
And they don't have all the catch-up and all these sort of things. And it's the same for people in geographical parts of the UK, where there is probably only one commercial radio station or a community radio station, and their only other sources of radio news and information is from the BBC.
Yes.
So until those parts of the country have commercial radio and more community radio stations, there is still a role for the BBC as a universal player. But I would take the BBC back to providing what it does or used to do very well, put it on two TV channels, keep it on the radio channels, and I would drop the license fee to a fiver a month.
Yeah.
Until we've moved to a place where they can take sponsorship and subscription. In fact, I would do that with all their local radio stations. I would move all their local radio stations to a bit in the way that they do it in the States with NPR, where the local station is supported by the local
community. It's an affiliate, yes.
And individuals who want to support that station, so that you've still got a mix of good commercial radio, and you've got this station that the community themselves support.
Yes.
And maybe it may make those stations better.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right, because there's no doubt that people do want to listen, and I'm all for having more radio rather than less radio, but what I'm not for is having this kind of, ridiculous monopoly in this country, which makes it totally impossible for anybody who wants to run a commercial radio station, made up of speech radio and maybe a few other bits of music that they want to do. It's a very, very difficult possibility to make any money. You just can't do it, because the BBC has all the money in that particular thing. But here's another one for you, which I didn't realise, Peter, and it is that basically there is a separate TV channel that provides news for aeroplanes. I got on a plane last year to go to America, switched on, what I thought was their offering on, the back of the seat, and they had this completely, it wasn't BBC World, it was a completely separate entity with completely different people, filmed from Broadcasting House in London, made just for the airline. Unbelievable.
It is, and we're all paying for that through the licence fee. And they're then selling things like BBC America, which carries adverts. And what we need to do is get the BBC back to what it was doing well, limit it to good quality news. And in fact, to make it balanced, I would almost have a committee made up of people from various newspapers, with The Economist, the Mail, The Mirror, whatever, to oversee the balance they say they have, they keep to.
You're absolutely right. Thank you, Peter, for your call. Let's talk to Craig, who's in Oxford. He wants to have his say as well. Hello, Craig.
Morning, Mike. Hi.
Very well, sir. What can I do for you?
Yeah, I'm completely fed up of the BBC. It's as has been said, it's effectively a television tax that's compulsory to most people.
Yeah.
Their coverage lately and last few years has been completely lopsided and impartial. Now, I think we'd all agree that the BBC, when it first came out, when television was in its infancy, was brilliant. It served a brilliant purpose and was, it laid the foundations for where we are today. However, just like the cassette tape was first in portable audio, it's obsolete now. It serves no real function. I mean, I pay God knows how much it is a year to watch a bit of Doctor Who and Match of the Day.
You're still watching Doctor Who? I can't believe it. I fell upon it by accident the other day. It was awful.
Yeah. It's more like, when you start a bad film and you're like, well, I'm committed now. You just kind of want to see how it ends.
No, I can't. I just couldn't watch it. It's just ridiculous. It's totally ridiculous. Yeah. Woke Doctor Who is not for me.
Yes, it has started. Some of the films have started going a bit like that, unfortunately. And it's the same with most of what they offer. Anything that's any good, like I say, would be picked up commercially by something else. And the rest of it is just drool that's just, force-fed on you, that you're being forced into funding. And we shouldn't have to put up with it anymore. I mean, I've got a feeling they'll lose the Match of the Day if the Premier League goes for their subscription service model, because they'll just do the analysis show themselves.
Yeah.
So after that goes, it's what do you do?
Well, exactly. I mean, I've even stopped watching Match of the Day, to be honest, because, it's one of those things that you can see so many clips now throughout the course of the day. You can see most of the goals on Twitter before you've even got there. So in the end, it's not even that interesting to watch a bloke who's getting well overpaid to do links between football matches and who doesn't have an opinion. Craig, thanks very much indeed. Craig in Oxford there talking about why he doesn't think the BBC will survive.
Talk radio across the UK, online, on DAB, and on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
If you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1 Monday to Friday on Talk Radio via DAB online or via the Talk Radio app. And if you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us on 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.